Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
Good morning, Kayla the Costco Ho on the board today. Clutch Larson in the booth. Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, running around getting things done. Brendan McDonald, nowhere to be seen. Wayne Gelman is sitting here in the studio for reasons I'm not sure of. Did you just...
Well, every once in a while, I'm granted dispensation to walk through here and say hello. But I have to commend everyone's attention this morning.
Oh, you had a dream?
I had a dream.
All right. Wait.
Much like Dr. King.
Wayne Gelman has had a dream,
I had a dream, you know, and one day that... No. all men will be equal. No, I woke up around 2:30 this morning, and Jonathan Larson was in my dream.
Clutch Larson, our producer. Let me just say, clear some stuff up, because we are going into Austin the first time today, and they're probably like, wait, who are these people?
Yes.
That's Austin, Texas, 1600 AM, KOKE. We're on there now. Wayne Gelman is our news guy. Clutch Larson is our producer, so there you have to speak. Go ahead.
All right. Larson was dressed in white.
Yeah.
And we were at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. For some reason, I saw him operating on Bill Clinton.
Wow.
I'm not making this up.
Yeah.
Yes, you are.
No, seriously. Because I never dream of people, particularly people I work with.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And,
I've been working with him for 30 years.
No, never dreamt of me.
Never been in there.
No. But for some reason, he was dressed in white. He was at the hospital. He's operating on Clinton. And he asked me for some pliers.
Wow. So Larson's like, Wayne, give me the pliers.
Give me the pliers, Wayne.
The question is, did you have the pliers?
No.
Oh, you didn't have the pliers.
Oh, you woke up?
Yeah,
you freaked out? I thought
I was late for work.
That's a very interesting dream.
I need an interpretation.
Okay, let me try and do it. I'm really curious. I'm curious about the pliers. But I don't know. It seems like a political dream where, you know, Larson obviously didn't know if he could finish the operation, right, without the pliers. So, you know, not unlike Larson, he has sort of like switched it, so it was kind of your fault.
Landing on a black guy.
Oh, my goodness. Right.
So Larson was like, where are the pliers? And you're like, you had that beat, and you woke up as opposed to getting caught up in it.
I couldn't get back to sleep. I can't figure out why I would think of Jonathan.
So Larson, did you succeed? Did you finish the operation without the pliers?
Uh-oh. His lips are sealed.
He's just going to sit there.
Larson says he didn't know because he doesn't pay credence to. See, I expect if somebody is in my dream that they should be able to answer for it the next day. I mean, is that too much to ask for? To go, you know what, Wayne? Go up and just ask Larson what his expectations were.
What I have for dinner.
I got to go to my special dream website and find out what pliers are.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely, man. So, Riley, what'd you do this weekend, man?
It was a pretty quiet weekend for me. Actually, I went for a fundraiser for a friend of mine who's running for. Remember, you were talking about people running for boards of education and municipal councils and that
getting
sort of
involved,
thing.
Folks.
Yeah. Well, a friend of mine who's the associate dean at the City College at the School of Engineering is running for a local school board. Anybody can do it. Well, yeah, and this guy is ultimately capable, quite capable. And, you know, he had a house full of people. I mean, it was incredible. Yeah, I mean, the place was absolutely packed. He's a musician, so he actually played some music.
Which is one of the qualifying things for running for school board.
An absolute qualifier, and I use as an example Bill Clinton, who played the saxophone. And this guy just, you know, he took Q&A from the audience, got their feelings about, you know, what needed to be done in the school system. It was an interesting little event.
I'm amazed that you would actually attend the fundraiser, knowing you.
What do you mean?
The fundraiser.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Fundraiser.
Here we go.
You're trying to say I'm cheap.
Yeah, well.
Mr. The rent is due. Trying to say, well, I'm cheap.
You know,
Mr. Banging right. on the that's door right. with the big, you know, pork pie hat on his head, talking about, where's my rent?
Exactly.
This is the Battle of the Tightwads.
That's right.
Gentlemen.
Now, what's today? The 14th?
This is the Battle of the Tightwads.
Yeah. Everything is up to speed. Don't worry about that.
Oh, everybody paying?
I don't like deal
Can
breakers.
Can I ask you a question? Wayne?
Right.
As a landlord, is it your responsibility to maintain upkeep of the pipes and the fittings in your building?
Oh, but of course.
No.
your responsibility to make sure that there is heat in the building?
Oh, no. Course.
Is it your responsibility to make sure that the building is exterminated properly?
Yes, it is.
All right, good. Then I'm in the right. Because my landlord, you know, I went out and paid for this. This was funny. You know, he's putting his dentist's office in the building because he couldn't afford the rent where he was going to pay him. Where he was paying before he was a dentist.
Yeah.
So now, of course, everything in the building is put on hold. All right. My faucets are leaking. I haven't been exterminated in like 6 months. So I said, the hell with this. I went and paid for the exterminator. I fixed my own toilet because the guy said, I'm not paying for a $5 part.
You take it out of the rent?
Well, that's what I did. Okay. I took it out of the rent. Now, if I did that to you, what would you do? What would be your first response?
Well, first of all, I would have a properly working toilet.
No, I'm not saying.
You know, but I would be upset. I would be pissed.
I took the money out of the rent without. Yeah. So I did it. He didn't say nothing about it. And my faucets were still leaking, right? But he was like, I can't afford the kit that I'm going to need to fix the plumbing. So knowing that I didn't put the money in the rent, I'll tell you, the guy came in 3 days ago, the super.
Only that.
And tracked all kinds of crap in my house. But that's besides the point. Got into my tub, fixed the things.
Mark.
They're not leaking anymore. All right? And then the guy's like, now he's not going to take. He says, where's my rent? You know, so I gave him the rent. Now the rent's got to be on time because he did what I told him to do, and I respect that. But he can't talk to me. He has to talk to me through this intermediary guy, the super. Like the guy, the landlord, will talk to me. He'll send the super over there. But, Wayne, even the landlord's standing right there.
Uh-huh.
Right? And the super can't speak English for hardly at all.
Yeah.
And Carlos
well,
will be standing,
for that. Yeah.
He'll be standing just looking at me, and he'll send Lewis over to talk to me down the hall when I'm looking at him. And he's sitting there going, Carlos said he's not going to pay for it. And the guy will talk to me. See how politics works? This is going to be the theme of the day, because it's weird when people in power can get someone else to do it and have that guy be blamed for whatever problems they're going to be. The thing is, with landlords, it goes both ways. If you got a super who's saying he's not going to pay for it, and then you go, well, I want him to pay for it, and then he's like, there's nothing I can do with it. He's not going to pay for it. Is that you go? They play both sides.
Well, every once in a while you have to act that way. I mean, I understand what you were going through. It's a major inconvenience, especially if your toilet's not working and things are backing up.
It wasn't a backup thing. It was like
the plunger, replacing
the plunger. That was it. But it's $5.
Yeah, but take it from someone who deals with tenants and toilets every weekend.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an easy thing to go up, you know, to have to bang on the door, straighten out a problem, and then be told that you're late for rent. Now, I know there's some people who happen to listen to me who also rent for me, and it's not directed at them. If they're listening.
Never them.
But, you know, I mean, when the first of the month comes, pay me.
He's trying to depict himself as a fair, nice guy.
Don't
misunderstand. I'm still a hard ass. If you live in one of my buildings.
Yeah. You know, it's actually time for you to move. You know, I have the place for you.
Did you do?
And I think you may qualify for Section 8. Yes.
Well, the Bronx.
Oh, my Section 8.
Dude, my landlord, when the woman next door died, okay, she died. She lived in there by herself, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, I'm on a trip for 10 days. I come back, and Carlos, he decides to talk to me about this. He's like, have you seen the lady next door? And I'm like, no, I haven't seen her in like a week and a half. It's like, I don't know what's going on in there. I'm like, you don't know what's going on there. She's 86. Why don't you call the police? He's like, no, we're going to turn the lights off. And he's going to turn the electricity off first if he flushes her out. She's been laying in there dead for 2 weeks. This guy's idea is like, you know what? I'm going to turn the electricity off. Maybe that'll make her come out. I'm like, you should call the cops, you idiot. So I'm home from vacation one day. The cops come knock on my door. They got to climb over my balcony to get into her apartment. And she's been dead for 2 weeks. This is the kind of guy she is. I'm not. It's Monday. Folks, and she's been dead for a while, and it, you know, it was a sad thing, but it was more an example of about how my landlord.
Everyone
works.
Has a Carlos, though, you know.
Yeah, and you are the Carlos.
Yeah. No, I have Negro. Negro is just as bad as
Negro.
Carlos. Yeah,
is that what they call you?
No.
I didn't know where that was going either.
Oh, I know. You got those two guys.
Listen,
the two muscular guys with the bandanas.
I had to do the local headlines. That's true.
All right,
I'm out of here.
Yeah. Good seeing you, Wayne.
Same here. Always a pleasure.
The dream, we'll get to the analysis.
Please,
we're
going
to do it. We're going to do it with the rest of them. You come back and retell it on, what is that, tomorrow?
Larson, yeah, I think it is tomorrow.
Dream interpretation.
All right.
We'll come back. I'm having an argument with somebody about this Ward Churchill character, but it's got nothing to do. I want to talk about something that happens in the progressive and liberal world, which is that, you know, we have a hard time isolating our you know, how am I going to say it? Is that The argument is about not – this woman wants to argue about what Ward Churchill, the guy from Boulder, the Colorado professor, the little Eichmann guy, what he was talking about as opposed to what that particular incident in terms of people like David Horowitz and some of the right who was trying to sort of undermine tenured professors, you know, on the basis of like, well, state money is funding their treasonous dialogue. And it didn't work, which is a success for the left. But, you know, they don't see, you know, people on the left are like, they're more hung up with what he said than what it really represents in terms of his victory. I'd like to talk about that a little bit. It's 16 past the hour. Air America Radio, good morning.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Worker.
Wow, little Lemmy in the morning. All right, 20 past the hour, morning edition with Mark Riley.
Hi.
And myself, Mark Maron. So what do you know? Democracy. To crush fascism internally must demonstrate its capacity to make the trains run on time. It must develop the ability to keep people fully employed and at the same time balance the budget. It must put human beings first and dollars second. It must appeal to reason and decency and not to violence and deceit. We must not tolerate oppressive government or industrial oligarchy in the form of monopolies and cartels. As long as scientific research and inventive ingenuity outran our ability to devise social mechanisms to raise the living standards of the people, we may expect the liberal potential of the United States to increase. If this liberal potential is properly channeled, we may expect the area of freedom of the United States to increase. The problem is to spend up our rate of social invention in the service of the welfare of all people. This is from The Danger of American Fascism by Henry A. Wallace, written in 1944. Pretty interesting.
Henry Wallace.
Yeah, but the dude was on you know, he was on the mark, and that's what, 60 years ago, in light of what we're going through now. I've become sort of obsessed with characterizing in a very real way the current administration, neocon death cult, and the Christo-fascist zombie brigades that operate at its behest as somewhat of a fascist regime. And I know people get really hung up when you throw the word fascist around. They're sort of like, oh, dude, come on, don't talk about Nazis. Don't talk about Hitler. You can't really make that comparison. Fine, but you can make it to fascism. And, you know, speaking of the intellectual freedom to go ahead and say that, now, I've been having this argument with a friend of mine over the email about Ward Churchill, who appeared on Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect or whatever his new show is, Bill Maher Real Time, the other night, which I didn't see.
Mm-hmm.
And she's basically saying, I think this guy is a bad representation of the left. I think he's a bad spokesperson for the left. I don't think that he should be given the airtime. I think that he's easily targeted by the right. That's all the wrong arguments and all the wrong things to say about this guy Ward Churchill. It doesn't matter what the hell you think of what he's saying or what the hell you think he is. The truth of the matter is this was a guy that was targeted by the right, targeted by people like David Horowitz for speaking his mind. The little Eichmann reference that he made. This is what got all the flack going. He was supposed to speak at Colgate, and then some professor up there read his essay that referred to the victim of 9/11 as little Eichmann's, and then he researched more of the guy's stuff and said he didn't want the guy speaking there. They canceled the engagement, so then he was put on trial, basically, in a kangaroo court of idiots, you know, within the state of Colorado, and the governor there, and people like David Horowitz saying that this guy's a treasonous professor, and he should be taken out because state funds pay for this school. And the truth of the matter is he's tenured and he's protected and he should have the right to say whatever the hell he wants within the academic structure that he exists in. He had to give up his seat as chair of, Ethnic Studies?
Yeah.
Okay. So the issue I'm trying to make is it doesn't matter what the hell the guy was saying. The issue is that he won. He was targeted by the right, and he was not taken out. Now, precedent was not set to dismantle tenured professors within, you know, academic institutions. Basically, his job, in my eyes, doesn't matter what he's saying. And now she's saying, well, he's a plagiarist. You know, he was, he's a hustler. He's this. He's that. There's plenty of those people out there in the world of academics. Academics, a lot of times, especially if they have a vague discipline, which isn't physics or some sort of engineering. They have to put on a show to keep kids engaged. And this guy is putting on the show of the left. He's getting people excited about social programs, about, rising up against the man, about, you know what I mean, ethnic diversity. That's his job.
But see, the true test of, in my judgment, people who speak in favor of and say they advocate for the First Amendment is a question of whether or not you're prepared to support someone's right to speak, no matter how distasteful you may find them personally, or how distasteful you find what they say.
That's what pisses me off about the left, is that she's going to sit there and get hung up on you know, who this guy is and what he has to do and what he has to say and how he represents the left and whether or not the right's going to target him. You know, the left sometimes is their own worst damn enemy, because we're sitting here trying to outguess the right in terms of who we're going to put up there, as opposed to all getting on the same page and saying, hey, he beat him, all right? He still got his job. You know, freedom of expression still exists at the University of Colorado in Boulder because the right was not able to take away his tenure, right?
Well, yeah, and I mean, the bottom line here is, the right, when one of theirs is attacked, they gather their forces together and they get behind that person or that institution or whatever it is whose speech is being questioned. They jump behind the First Amendment as fast as the left does. So why, and by the way, they don't care what the left does or what the left thinks about what they do. They don't. Yeah. They really don't. They're not sitting there saying to themselves, well, gee, I wonder whether that person's going to be an easy target for the left. We're not going to have. Look, Armstrong Williams, okay,
yeah,
who was roundly criticized by liberals and conservatives alike,
right,
still has a gig. He starts today,
yeah.
Right here,
yeah,
in New York. So bottom line, that, you know, he is still working. People got behind him enough to say, you know what, he's not irredeemable. And Ward Churchill, no matter what you think about what he said, represents the ability to speak freely on a college campus, and that's lightning in the bottle. And the minute that starts to erode, we are, in fact, halfway down the road toward fascism.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And the thing is that on top of that, even if he's a little overinflated, even if he's an egotist, even if he's self-centered, if he's charging kids up with the right sort of spirit about what's important in this country, which are liberal causes, then God bless him. Thank God he's out there doing it. You know what I mean? You don't need the left to sit around going, I don't think he's a good representation of what the left is. I mean, Robert Reich and Noam Chomsky and, you know, I mean, Howard Zinn's a great example of what they should all be doing. It's like, look, okay, there's your holy trinity. Reich, Zinn, and Chomsky. Terrific. Man, I would sleep through that class, bro.
Well, you know, it's the same thing like they used to do with black folks and Floyd Patterson and Sonny Liston. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Both black boxers, but Floyd was the nice guy. The
I love Chomsky. I love Zinn. I love Rice, but I mean, let's not eat our own folks.
Let's not go crazy. We've got more for you when we come back. We
torture.
Got torture. And we got the liberal agenda, too, here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Oh, my God. It's 34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. If you people only knew what happened when the mics go down in this place. When we are
you sure
mic,
the mic went down?
Dude, all I know is we should be doing a separate morning show on another network. And then we come back. Not that we're deceiving anybody. It's not quite right for this network, the kind of stuff that we talk about.
That's right.
But look, folks, good morning, Austin, Texas. We're on 1600 AM KOKE, day one. Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Air America family, if that is such. Tomorrow I'm going to be hanging out with Lewis Black on Randy Rhodes' show. He's going to be hosting. I'm going to be sitting there helping him, or hanging out, or
that's
laughing,
right,
and, you know, contributing, being Mark Maron there with Lewis Black. Lawton Smalls is on vacation this week, so we're taking your vote for your favorite Planet Bush reports at morningsedition.com, and we're playing the winners. That'll be, obviously, on Thursday. Go to morningsedition.com right now to vote, and tune in tomorrow, Tuesday. We do that two times a week. Man, wake up, buddy, to hear the first winner. Is it only on Tuesdays? Planet Bush? No, it's Tuesdays and Thursdays, right? Yeah, I know what I'm doing. Hey, folks, in reference to what I was talking about before in the Ward Churchill thing, I'm going to do the Palm Pilot in a minute because Ramon just dropped off the Palm Pilot dressed as Sam Houston. I don't know what the hell that could mean. But I just wanted to say that in the 14 characteristics defining fascist states by Lawrence W. Britt, which I've been hitting a lot in the last couple of weeks, number 11 is disdain and suppression of intellectuals and the arts. Intellectuals and inherent freedom of ideas and expression associated with them were an anathema to these fascist regimes. Intellectual and academic freedom were considered subversive to national security and the patriotic ideal. So once you start, the left starts eating itself and you start criticizing our own, just really ask yourself, who are you really servicing when you do that? Here is Tom DeLay's Palm Pilot for this morning. As you know, and we'll tell you later, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, or as I like to call him, the bug-killing dwarf king of the neocon death cult legislating pig pack, is having some heart problems after another stressful week of ethics allegations. So here's his Palm Pilot for today. 6 a.m. Wake up, turn to lobbyist in bed next to me and ask if he knows how to operate coffee machine. 8 a.m. Answer latest allegations. Have doctor claim that worrying about ethics strains the heart. 10 a.m. In wake of recent scandal, cancel lunch with lobbyists to have lunch with other lobbyists. Noon, low-fat lunch, cottage cheese, fruit, oat bran, two-pound brick of $100 bills. 2 p.m. To ease pressure on heart, change nickname from The Hammer to the miniature novelty-sized jeweler's hammer. Okay. 4 p.m. Fly to Korea on my own money this time, just to mess with people's heads. 8 p.m. Bedtime, cuddle up with nice, warm Korean lobbyist. Have room service send up more if I catch a chill. More lobbyists, I guess that would be, because he likes the lobbyists. Look, if you don't know what's going on with Tom DeLay, we're going to get into that a little later in the show. Right now, we're going to turn our attention to a lot of things that are coming out around torture and murder on the behalf of the American military. There's some reports that came out over the weekend about tortured subjects in Afghanistan who were actually killed by the army. There's some reports going on about, obviously the ongoing sort of assumption that it was systemic, the torture, and it does go all the way to the top. But first I want to talk, Riley, about this European who are probing the CIA in their role of abductions. Apparently in Spain, a local Muslim cat there, I don't know if he was a cleric or what, but there was just, these masked people just came up to him, chloroformed him, threw him in a car, and the guy disappeared. He went on Air Torture, which is owned by the CIA.
Yeah.
They're the ones with the, they've got on the tail, they've got the guy standing there with the hood on his head from Abu Ghraib.
That's cold.
Yeah, I know. But apparently, what the Europeans are responding to is, who the hell do these people think they are, i.e. us, i.e. the CIA, just coming and picking up their citizens in the middle of the day and chloroforming them, throwing them in a truck, flying them to the middle of nowhere to torture them where it's okay to torture?
Yeah, this was a guy named Abu Omar. He was actually abducted from Milan in Italy.
Why did I say Spain? in Italy. That's right.
Yeah, and this kind of renditioning. See, when you look at what happened to this guy, and by the way, he has not been seen since February of 2000. That's two full years now. Nobody knows where he is. But when you start looking at this sort of thing and the kind of play it gets in the European press, is it any wonder that people take seriously the allegations of the journalist who was abducted by the Iraqis that maybe they were maybe the Americans were targeting her at that checkpoint?
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, there's some stuff about the checkpoint too, but we'll get into that.
This is what is known as extraordinary renditioning.
Renditioning, yeah.
But it was my belief, my initial assumption, Riley, around extraordinary renditioning is that it was really about, immediately taking people in a place that were actually in conflict and moving them to where, to affiliated, torturing states like Jordan or Egypt or whatnot to circumvent.
Yeah.
The Geneva Conventions, and also our own laws here in the United States.
All of that's true, but now there is documented evidence that they were even renditioning people from our allies. You take a guy off the streets of Milan, you take a guy off the streets over in Germany.
Kidnapping.
It's essentially kidnapping, putting them on these planes, flying them to, in some cases, their home countries, but in other cases, to other states where the United States knows that people who are imprisoned could well be subject to torture. And at this point, Alberto Gonzalez, our attorney general, has defended the practice of renditioning before Congress.
But not maybe kidnapping. And the weird thing about these European renditioning is that, you know, a lot of times this state that's, you know, our ally does not know that it's gone on or it's happened. You know, the communications break down or they're not happening at all. Who's investigating this, Riley?
Well, at this point, that's a very interesting question. In Italy, it is Italian authorities, plus there were some Americans that showed up at the Aviano Air Base in northern Italy and demanded the they demanded records of any American planes that had flown into or out of the military installation around that February 2003 time when this guy, Abu Omar, was abducted. They asked for logs of vehicles that had entered the base, and now it is Italian authorities, along with American officials, are starting to say that this was this has all the earmarks of a CIA operation. There are wiretaps that were revealed in sealed Italian court papers that were reviewed by the Washington Post, and that says that there was authorization by a judge to continue a wiretap and show that investigators were pursuing the theory that covert agents were behind that kidnapping.
That's scary. And the records show that a jet, if you're ever on board or are planning a trip on Premier Executive Transfer Services Incorporated, that records suggests that they CIA front company. And if you're on that plane, you're headed for trouble. It's not going to be a vacation of any kind. It's probably a torture junket to Jordan, Egypt, or one of the other torture-sanctioning states that we are allied with.
And it's happened in Germany. It's happened in Greece. There's some question about Macedonia being involved here.
It just scares the hell out of me because it's everything you see in, like, weird sort of spy thrillers and stuff. Just like a van pulling up, you know, with tinted windows. Four guys get out with masks, grab you off the street, put the rag on your face with chloroform. Bam, you're out. The next thing you know, you wake up. You're hanging from your ankles in a cell being electrocuted in front of a dog. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, what the hell is that? And it, like, what I'm frightened about is if they're doing this, you know, there, you got to know that they can do it here. And maybe I'm paranoid, but you know,
No. That is not paranoia. Remember that what we're talking about here is one aspect of renditioning, the renditioning of people from allied countries. Remember that over this past weekend, a federal judge blocked the transfer of 13 Yemeni prisoners in a different kind of renditioning from the facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Now, that federal judge, Rosemary Collier of the U.S. District Court, is saying that that won't, at this point, happen until there is a hearing on concerns on the part of the lawyers for these Yemenis that they could be tortured if they're sent to Egypt, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, whatever. And they're saying, of course, that according to one of the lawyers, if they were moved, the jurisdiction of the court over the case would effectively be dissolved. In other words, there would be no U.S. court that would have jurisdiction over these folks. They wouldn't be able to get a fair hearing in front of certainly a U.S. court. And, of course, the idea...
But that means they won't be able to get a hearing anywhere. Is that true?
Exactly.
All right, so this is one of those weird sort of kind of gray areas that this administration is, you know, very aware of creating, where, you know, that these kind of horrendous transgressions in terms of you know, the Geneva Conventions, and where these transgressions of law and international law and local law occur because they've created a gray area where they can let them happen, and then until they're called on it, then they can go, yeah, well, that's a good point, but, you know, obviously we had this thing into place, that this secret, super secret place where people could just get tortured and we do whatever we want.
Well, remember that the government is talking about transferring at least half the detainees at Guantanamo, half of 540 people, which is 270, to other prisons in other countries. Now, the problem with that is the Americans suspect these detainees of being terrorists, but they have not proven in a court of law, or for that matter, any place else, that they are in fact terrorists, that they are in fact members of Al-Qaeda.
So they figure if they could just bring them somewhere where they could really give it to them, that then they get to it,
and they would get information that they were looking for. Remember, they're trying to get information out of these people. That's the root of the abuse in the first place, and that is the sorriest part of the abuse, because information that you get from people you torture is notoriously unreliable.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not good information. Agency yes. after agency, time after time. Even the CIA says that's discredited. We had people on the air here who yeah. said it was discredited.
Because if you get to a point where you cause enough pain, they'll say whatever you want them to
exactly.
say.
Exactly.
That happens in just regular law enforcement. I mean, come on, I saw a marathon. Is it safe? Oh, no, it's not, that's not safe at all. You can't, I wouldn't go in there, don't. It's not very safe. Yes, it's very safe.
Yeah. Now, right. on Saturday, the Defense Department says they've transferred three detainees from Guantanamo to Afghanistan, oh. Maldives, and Pakistan for release, they say.
Hey, how could you? That must be like, what kind of prize is that? Guess what? We're going to let you go in Afghanistan.
In Afghanistan.
Wait a minute.
How long you figure you're going to be free in
yeah,
Afghanistan?
Yeah, right. Pakistan. We're sending you to Pakistan.
One Mississippi, two Mississippi. Yeah.
We got some friends in Pakistan that said they'll set everything up for you. They got a place for you to live. And,
yeah. The sheriff says it's okay. Don't worry about it.
There's an outlet there that they can hook the things that they're going to hook to your testicles to. Well, we're going to talk about Afghanistan when we come back
yes.
because a couple of people were killed by the United States Army during torture. They, you know, what do you call it? Unapproved torture tactics, and then the people that set up those places of torture went on to work in Iraq, and they say it's not systemic.
Yeah.
We're going to address that when we come back. It's 46 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Rob Corddry from The Daily Show, here to remind you that when top news reporters and investigative journalists like me want their news skewed so far to the left it's wearing a dress, we turn to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Good morning. It's Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
You're listening to Air America Radio. Good morning, Austin, Texas, one of my favorite towns. We're on 1600 AM, KOKE, live every morning from 5 to 8 there in Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
Love that place. That sound is the sound of the fax machine. Every day we get a fax from the Streisand compound with our marching orders. Here's today's. One, start feeling conflicted about Ken Lay. Hate him for his corporate corruption, but offer to publish his sensitive prison poetry. Two, protest idea of Condoleezza Rice becoming commander-in-chief. When you hear she won't run, complain that no black women are running for president. Three, applaud American Idol finalists for dropping out. Why do we have to have winners and losers? Can't we all win? Four, applaud Michael Jackson's accuser of having the guts to buck national opinion and point out that Jackson is kind of a wing nut. Yeah, that's a put it lightly. Five, today's phrase, just drop it in the conversation. The glaciers are shrinking in the Himalayas. Am I the only one who read about this? Get your head out of the ice, sheeple. You think you can live without Himalayan glaciers? Think again. Wake up. All right, buddy. Let's crunch into this, man. Let's do the, let's hyper-parse. You
sure.
ready to hyper-parse?
I'm ready.
The UN, the UN Human Rights Commission, Riley. Lay it out.
They're meeting today, starting today in Geneva. This is a 7-week-long meeting. I can't imagine what they're going to be talking about for that long. Well, not that they don't have topics.
Well, they plan their vacation around it. You know,
yeah.
one day it's like, what do we got today? Well, 1 o'clock genocide, but then we can go to that place for dinner.
Yeah, exactly. And what's happening now is that for the United States, chickens are starting to, I hate to use that term, you know, Malcolm X got in a lot of trouble.
Are we roosting?
Yeah, they're coming home to roost, okay? Everybody figured that Abu Ghraib and all these other exposés about how the United States treats prisoners would have no consequence. The fact of the matter is that it's starting to have consequence
yes.
now because the United States has eroding and constantly eroding credibility when it comes to pointing out human rights abuses in other countries.
Not the good guys anymore.
Not the good guys anymore by any stretch of the imagination. Now, let's be real about this. This meeting, 53 countries are taking part in it. And you know, part of what the Americans have a problem with is the fact that Cuba and Zimbabwe are on this Human Rights Commission. Now, they may have a very legitimate point in terms of saying, you know, Cuba and Zimbabwe do, in fact, abuse human rights. That may be absolutely true. But the fact is Latin American countries name Cuba, African countries name Zimbabwe. You know, of course, those are the two, you know, Condoleezza Rice has nothing good to say about them. She called them outposts of tyranny. But how can the United States argue back when Abu Ghraib and all of these other revelations being exposed.
We're no longer a barometer of integrity, not just Cuba and Zimbabwe, did you say?
Yeah.
But how about this? I mean, what about the guy, the Sudan's deputy UN ambassador, Omar Bashir Mana, said, we may be overseeing a genocide, but who are you guys to talk?
Yeah.
And now if we got to play on the same playing field as they do, I'm not going to say we. I'm talking about, not necessarily the collective country here, but, those who are in support of the neocon death cult's agenda of torture abroad. I mean, we no longer have, we're now at a level playing field with people who have transgressed human rights violators, global human rights violators on a profound scale.
What we are doing now is saying to the rest of the world, do as I say, not as I do.
As opposed to, you guys are bad.
Yeah, you guys are bad. And that's essentially what they've done in the past at these Human Rights Commission meetings, is the United States has taken various countries, probably in some cases, rightly so, to task for their human rights violations, locking people up in prison for extended periods of time without charging them, beatings, torturings, all of those things. And they happen in countries all over the world, and in all likelihood, a lot of countries at the UN don't have clean hands. And the problem is, neither do we.
That's right. And, apparently, I want to get into this if we can. We only got a minute or two here before we go into the break. But this Afghan prison abuse, this trial, which began apparently in 2002, there are two army guys who are being, one's being charged for manslaughter.
Yes.
All right. And it turns out that, it looks to me that this, they were, not only were they torturing the hell out of these people, but they weren't even following the rules of torture laid out by this country or by the Geneva Conventions. But they killed a couple of guys, and it was hidden. There were forged doctor's documents or forged, not forged, but they said it wasn't caused by the torture. And now, the U.S. is copping to it on some level, but still blaming underlings. So
Willie Brand is going to be he's charged with manslaughter. He's probably going to be the one that goes down on this. But understand this, Mark. This is something that, again, is going to come back to haunt. The American military and functionaries within the American military went to some large, great degree to cover this up.
Right. And then the woman who was there overseeing it, Captain Wood.
Carolyn Wood. Yeah.
The chief military intelligence officer in Afghanistan there, was then sent to Abu Ghraib to set up shop there. And if that isn't like proof of a systemic plan, the thing is that the big guys, Rumsfeld, Undersecretary Cambone, all these people that are at the top can detach themselves by saying, well, those guys are out of control.
Yeah.
There was a climate there that, something got crazy. Even if they were permissive about it, they are guilty through their complicity, through negligence.
Well, see, part of their strategy now, Mark, is to go before this Human Rights Commission and say, well, hey, we're Americans. We prosecute the people that do wrong under these
circumstances. Look, this one guy is going to pay for it.
This is so paper thin, it should go to the top. It is sickening. It should go right to the top. And America really does have to put its cards on the table at this commission and say, yes, we have had problems. We are working to correct those problems. And we want other countries that have problems to do the same thing. And be honest about what America has done here.
The trickle-down, principle of blame is so inherent in the U.S. government, in corporate crimes. We're going to get into that. It's sort of a theme today, right?
Yeah. And when we come back, we're going to have our last segment from Dinner with Daniel.
A little relief, a little dinner.
Yeah. And, of course, we're also going to have Kurt Eichenwald from the New York Times to talk about Enron here on Air America Radio.
Weather.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor but are willing to tolerate us. Good morning to you, Mark Riley. I'm saying good morning again.
Good morning, Mark Merritt.
Thank you, buddy. We have some people tuning in for the first day in Austin, Texas. We're on 1600 AM, KOKE. We're going out live to Texas. I'd like to say hi to our new affiliates when they do happen. Isn't that exciting?
Yeah.
Austin, Texas. Austin, Texas, I'd really like you to meet Kalo the Costco Ho on the board. We got Clutch Larson in the booth and P.W. McDonald in the booth. Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman of New Jersey, is out in the night finding information to feed us. So now, what we were in the middle of, and, you know, I want to get back to it because I feel like we rushed it, Riley. We rushed the sort of, you know, the hyper-parsing, the not just the Human Rights Commission, which is going to be this seven-week event where we are no longer, you know, part of the good guys.
Yeah.
But the Afghani prison abuse that had been going on apparently since 2002, and now we got a guy, we got a Willie V. Brand, a soldier. He's a private.
Private first class, yes.
Private first class is charged with manslaughter in a case where these two Afghani prisoners were died. They died in American custody. And the reason that, you know, I want to talk about this is that I think because of what happened and the lies that were told after you do the responsible reporting, is that I think it proves that it was in, and most of us on this side of the ideological world believe that it was clearly systemic and that more people higher ups should pay.
Well, we ought to, at this point, Mark, salute Human Rights Watch. They're the ones that are really doing the hard work to expose all of this nonsense and foolishness that's going on. And they now say that the abuses that began in Afghanistan in 2002, well before anyone knew anything about Abu Ghraib, were part of a systematic pattern of mistreatment, of which Private First Class Willie Brand was just one glaring example. Now, this guy beat a man named Dilawar, and this is a detainee, allegedly beat the guy, 37 times. He's accused of having maimed and killed him over a five-day period. His legs were in such bad shape, this guy Dilawar, that had he lived, they would have had to have been amputated.
I think he died of some sort of embolism because of blood clots that were
all throughout his legs. Yeah. Yes. So this man was beaten and beaten very badly, and it appears at this point, according to reports both by the Army's Criminal Investigation Command and the research done by Human Rights Watch, that the chain of command lied and alibied about this death. There certainly hasn't been a lot of news about the trial of Willie Brand and the other soldiers.
And this was in the paper. This piece that I saw, it was in the paper on Saturday. It's like, you know, the day that no one's reading the paper. And the sad thing is that these doctors they were signing off on the idea that he died of natural causes.
Yeah.
A naturally caused embolism from being, you know, kneed behind the legs to the point where it crippled him and clotted his blood. For what? I mean, at what point do you realize that this type of torture does not get the information you want? It's not even clear the guy was necessarily guilty of anything.
Well, see, here's the nutshell. Here's the whole thing in a nutshell. This is from a gentleman named John Sifton, who's from Human Rights Watch.
Human Rights Watch guy, yeah.
Yeah. Quote, the Bush administration and the Pentagon described the abuse problems as isolated incidents, not systemic, not part of a plan. The evidence shows otherwise. Far from being isolated incidents, these beatings were part of a pattern of abuse. Now, how far up do you go with the pattern of abuse?
Well, an encouraged pattern. Let's start with Captain Carolyn A. Wood,
yes,
the chief military intelligence officer overseeing that stuff in Afghanistan. Am I right?
Yes.
And then was restationed to where? Abu Ghraib. To help set up shop there. So right there, in a nutshell, that at least goes up as high as her, if not higher. She had to be approved by somebody.
Yeah. She set up the interrogation and debriefing center at Abu Ghraib, and the two Defense Department reports say that a list of interrogation procedures she drew up there, went way beyond those approved by Army commanders. In other words, the woman was writing her own book.
Yes.
It is incredible.
And it was like that kind of stuff does not happen without some sort of, you know, complicity of all the way up. You know, I think that they actually make decisions around that. It's like, well, let's let them run wild. And then when we get busted, this is the way power works, I guess, in the world, because I'm sort of naive, is that, you know, you get people that will do anything to maintain and gain power and control over a situation through greed or wealth or just territory. And then if they set it up properly, they are able to, once they get busted for transgressing, you know, some sort of law, whether it's international or local law, they've designed it so they have enough people to blame that it doesn't touch them.
Exactly. It doesn't go all the way up the chain of command.
It happens in all hierarchies of power. It happens in show business. It happens, in the corporate world. It happens everywhere. That the person that deliberates power the best in the evil world that we live in is the one that can protect himself the most?
Well, what ends up happening, Mark, is that people will, for example, somebody says, well, we're not getting enough information from these detainees. We need information, we need intelligence, and we're not getting it. Get it for us. And that goes to whoever it is that's in charge of the interrogations. Get us more information. Get us better information. That says to the interrogators that whatever techniques they're using at that point are not satisfactory. They're not enough. And so then they think, well, what else can we do?
Right.
They hear about a memo from Alberto Gonzalez saying, gee, you know, the Geneva Convention may not apply to this specific group of detainees. So the chain of command lets them know they can go a little further than they have been going in the past.
Sure, it also sends a message, too,
yeah.
So that it frightens people on the street. And, you know, a lot of people will say, well, look, you know, what else are we going to do? You know, what else are we going to do, you know, with this terrorist problem? How are we going to get the information? How are we going to find this stuff out? You do it, you know, within the confines of the Geneva Conventions, and you wait it out. You know,
yeah.
I mean, the thing is weird to me is that this was clearly a sign. You know, they were beating the hell out of these guys relentlessly to send a message out there that, you know, once you come on in, tell us what you know, or you're going to end up like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And they, you know, set up this chain, as you very correctly point out, of plausible deniability.
That's
I didn't tell called. Anybody to torture anybody. I didn't say to somebody, well, you know, go ahead and beat this guy 37 times. He's responsible for that. The private's the one that did it.
Me.
And we all know that there was a culture of violence at these prisons, whether it's Gitmo, whether it's in Afghanistan, whether or not it's at Abu Ghraib. It's all part and parcel of the same culture, and that culture went too far, and somebody's got to admit it.
Yeah, but it's going to stop. It's going to stop at that level of Sanchez, was he the lieutenant colonel?
Ricardo Sanchez?
Yes.
Yeah.
They ain't going to get that high. It ain't going to get as Karpinski's not going to do any time. It's going to be these low-level grunt guys.
Well, Karpinski has access to meet the press, so my guess is
blame dispersal, man.
Yeah,
plausible deniability. We'll be back. We're going to lighten it up a little bit. We're going to go out to dinner at a very nice restaurant. 14
yeah.
past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your vlog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Team past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Every day, my therapist tells me to make a dream diary so I can bring him in on Thursday to see what I'm thinking. Here's my dream from last night. I'm late for a play. I get to the theater and my seat is in the middle of the house in the middle of the row. It's the only seat out of the 2,000 in the place that's empty. Everyone is giving me the dirty, what's wrong with you, you irresponsible idiot look. Get a watch, stupid, one guy says. The lights go down, and I'm trying to make my way to the seat, but no one is moving their legs. As I climb over people, they're making comments. Hey, ow, watch it, buddy. Selfish. It's always about you. Inconsiderate. Overrated. Fraud. Not funny. Dirty Jew. All right, that's enough, I say. Take it easy. I'm from New Mexico here. You shut up and sit down, my fifth grade teacher from history class, Mr. Powers says. We're here to see a show and learn about politics. Stop disrupting the entire species. What the hell? I sit down in my seat. My mother is sitting next to me on one side, and my father's on the other side, sleeping. Then the lead character comes out. He's this huge fat guy, probably weighed about 300 pounds, and he's wearing round glasses like mine. He's wearing my pants, and they're way too small, and they're pushing all his fat up, so he looks like he's about to explode. Then I realize, it's me. It's the fat me. I look like I'm about to cry. My mother tries to cover my eyes and says, you didn't have to eat the rice pudding. This is awful. People are going to know you're mine. Then Fat Me starts weeping on stage and pulls his shirt up to reveal a perfectly rounded semi-sphere of fat that has a map of the world on it. He points to China and says, they're going to take it all. We owe them too much. There are more of them and they eat more than us. I'm trying to keep up, as you can see, for America. The audience jumps up in spontaneous standing ovation, screaming, bravo, genius, yes, except for my dad, he's still sleeping. I undo my pants and I sit down on the stage with my belly cradled in my cross legs, smiling, the Mark Buddha. I say, I don't even like Chinese food that much, really. Do you guys? I woke up and my bed was filled with mushu pork. Okay, moving on. This is our final installment. Too weird, right? This is my final installment from Mark and I and Dan Pashman and Brendan McDonald had dinner at Daniel Balud's restaurant. It's the nicest restaurant in the world. We're definitely outclassed, but we made some nice radio out of it. So here's the final installment of our dinner at Daniel.
What's the best meal you've ever had?
What was your name?
You know, I don't know if I can recall the best meal, but I can tell you about the most interesting and bizarre meal.
Yeah.
Was at this place, I think it was called La Broche in Madrid. There was this raw shellfish terrine in a seawater gelatin.
This was only a couple years ago, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Because they've only started doing stuff like that recently.
Yeah, and it was like taking a bite out of the ocean. It was kind of disturbing, actually. And then they had this amuse-bouche that was basically an uncooked ham and cheese omelet. In a coffee mug?
Ham and cheese omelet in a coffee mug?
It was like raw eggs with ham and cheese.
Oh, that's disgusting. Where did you have this?
At this restaurant in Madrid. And then I had Colt for my entree, which was phenomenal.
Colt?
Like baby horse?
Colt 45?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I never knew.
Is this some sort of joke?
No, I'm dead serious. And then at dessert, I had squid ink ice cream, which my taste buds still have not
that's
been able
ridiculous.
To comprehend because it was so salty and so sweet. And
young
creamy.
Horse
with
and
black
squid
ice cream?
Squid ink ice cream.
Ice cream. The entree and squid
and
ink
you
ice
like,
cream.
And you like the Colt.
Mm.
I love the Colt. The raw shellfish seawater gelatin was disgusting.
When the chef came out, did you say, Chef, great Colt?
That's Alan Richman, the food critic.
What your favorite meal was. Was there a day when you ate all these foods you now don't eat?
I guess it would be my worst meal experience. I was about maybe 6 or 7 years old. And my mother decided she was going to make me eat something. Oh. So she put a bowl of oatmeal in front of me, knowing good and well I wasn't going to eat it, and said, you will not get up from this table until you eat this oatmeal. I sat at that table from 8 o'clock in the morning.
Pages flying off calendars.
Until the milk curdled, which was like about 6 o'clock that night.
You just sat there?
I sat there. I would not touch it.
And did your mother's heart ever sort of melt a little?
No, she smacked me and sent me to bed. But after that, she refused. I mean, after that, she really didn't make me eat anything that I didn't want to eat.
Oh.
You know, I think I kind of scared her a little bit. She wasn't
you're strong, man.
Yeah.
Tough guy.
I have a dream.
It was like believed in.
Uh-oh.
Wow. Here come the dessert trays. 20 people have processed our desserts. Yes. Oh, my God. I almost dropped the last piece of mousse. I literally felt horror and shock going
no,
my body.
No.
Exactly.
And what if you dropped it on your tie?
I still could have eaten it then. I was afraid it was going to hit the floor. Maybe not.
Here he goes. Here comes Dan.
Oh, really? I can't even remember all the different foods we had.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you didn't have to write it down. You only talked about it.
We're talking to Daniel, the owner and chef of the place. And genius. Just genius.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. No, I'm sorry. I crashed into the party here and just came out of my kitchen.
And you know what? I'm full.
Yeah.
It was great.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Here. Who was only? I've never heard him do anything but moan and groan about food. He was in heaven.
He was
yes.
surprised.
I was very pleasantly surprised.
And he ate goat cheese, which he's never eaten in his life.
No.
If you want, I can bring lunch at your studio.
It's so great that you still have a great time doing it.
Yeah, sure. What else am I gonna do?
Thank you so much. Unbelievable.
Thank you so much.
All the best.
Really appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
That was Daniel Balud. The chef who I was afraid to mispronounce his last name in front of.
I want you to know that when I had dinner in this very same little cubicle here with George Hamilton, Danielle did not come over to say hello to us, but you guys are so big, he came out of his kitchen to say hello to us.
Well, you know what that is, Alan. George Hamilton's frightening.
Can I just explain for people who can't see, there are 9 mini creme brulees in the middle of the table right now.
I forgot we were even taping them. I'm just like, sugar.
Riley, since you like coffee ice cream, I think you should try one coffee creme brulee.
I can't. No coffee creme brulee. I have to catch the creme brulee bus. But, folks, this has been one very, very special evening. I want to thank Alan for somebody as picky as me to be this satisfied and this full after. You got to understand about one thing about me. I am one of these people that until the last minute before I'm doing something, I'm trying to figure out a way not to do it. No, I'm not going over there. I got to wear a suit and tie to eat food. No, I'm not doing that. But I did it, and I am really, really glad I did. Thank you.
Well, I know I'm proud of you.
I get your creme brulees, right? I called it, Pashman.
That's fair.
Take care, Mark. Be careful.
See you later.
Mm-hmm. Riley's getting all weepy. Meanwhile, Marin was like already at his third mini creme brulee.
Riley's getting weepy. It's hard to match what he said, but boy, this has been amazing. I've never had a meal like this. Thanks, Alan. Thanks for having us. And where we're going next?
Hey, I'll go anywhere with you guys. First of all, the level of sophistication has just exhausted me. I can't keep up with you guys.
We're no George Hamilton.
The erudition was just brilliant. You guys are dining gods, and you didn't know it. Thank you for being so great and bringing me with you to this.
We're going to do it again. That's Alan Richmond. The book is Fork It Over. And this has been, we've been at Daniel in New York, one of the top two restaurants in the country.
I think so, easily.
I guess we're signing off. This is Morning's Edition from Daniel in New York. Wow. It took me 2 days to recover from that meal, dude.
Yeah, man. We were up late that night. That was the other
part. I know. It was 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
Are you finding it home till
9:30? 9:30. That's right. And, you know, it's like, hey, my daughter's still up. What's going on here?
Oh, no. I'm in trouble. Man, that thing was amazing. And we haven't done that again since. I guess we ought to try and get Alan Richmond to take us somewhere else. It's so funny because I'm a big foodie, you know, and I like food, but it's nice having a guy with connections where you're sort of like, yeah, we love you, Alan. We're hoping. I hope that book sells. Where are we going now? Who else do you know? Can you take us to a nice dinner or a nice lunch somewhere?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we ought to have him in and see what he's got going on. And then maybe go. We got Kurt. You know what? Kurt Eichenwald is going to be here. He was on 60 Minutes last night. Going to talk about Ken Lay. His book is The Conspiracy of Fools, a true story. It's about Enron, and he's going to give us the inside scoop on that if you didn't already know it.
Scary, scary stuff. When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition Program. Enron. Over $60 billion in shareholder wealth was lost. The teacher retirement system of Texas lost $23.3 million. The state of Connecticut lost $220 million spent on energy contracts awarded to Enron that may never be fulfilled. The Maryland State Pension Board lost $30.1 million. New York City Pension Fund lost $110 million. Ohio State Pension Fund lost $114 million. Kansas Public Employees Retirement System had about $1.2 million invested in about 82,000 shares of Enron stock. And those monies are connected to people's sense of security. Not to mention the employees that lost their jobs. Our guest, Kurt Eichenwald, has written a book. It is called Conspiracy of Fools, A True Story. This is Mr. Eichenwald on last night's broadcast of 60 Minutes.
Ultimately, what was it that killed Enron?
Everyone thinks Enron was killed by crime. It wasn't. Enron was killed by massive incompetence. Massive mismanagement.
We welcome now to our show New York Times writer Kurt Eichenwald. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I watched you on 60 Minutes, Kurt, and I got to tell you something. Every bone in my body wants to blame this guy. I don't want it to be incompetence. I want him to be an evil little bastard.
Well, ultimately, whether or not he committed a crime in the last 12 weeks, which is all he's charged with, you got to bear that in mind,
okay,
really has nothing to do with whether this company was going to go under or not. I mean, Ken Lay was in charge at a time when this company transformed itself into the biggest corporate nightmare in the world. We tend to get ourselves wrapped around the pole of well, was it a crime or not? And in my mind, that's almost beside the point. You have to stand back and say, what was it that happened here, and why did it happen here?
Right. Tell me about the charges again, though. In the last 12 weeks, explain to me what's really going on with that.
Well basically, Ken Lay has been indicted on charges that from September 26, 2001, to December 2nd, 2001, when Enron went under, that he gave false statements as to the health of the company at that time. There's another charge that relates to a complex accounting issue, not the company's actual accounting, but something they said they were going to do.
But bilking people out of millions of dollars in pension funds and everything else, that doesn't play into the legal language at all, huh?
No, because ultimately what has happened here, when you really delve into Enron, the financial machinations that took place, the things that really destroyed this company, were going on within the finance division. You see, the problem people have with Enron, this is not to say there are not crimes at Enron. There are a lot of crimes at Enron. But the reality is you could have doubled and tripled the number of crimes at this company, and it would have survived.
Right.
If you had cut the incompetence by half.
But it strikes me like, you know, I understand what you're saying, but I, for some reason in my heart, I want to, you know, blame the CEO. I think that, you know, he's the guy in charge. He should be taken to task. And I look at a guy like Kenway. He's a short, dumb looking guy. There's no way a guy like that gets to the power that he had without being a complete ass.
But what do you really think, Mark?
But am I wrong, Kurt?
Well, but you're saying something different. You're saying I want to blame him, and I'm saying feel free.
Okay. All right, thank you. As long as I have your permission, Kurt, I feel better this morning.
No, this is the problem when you get into a crime. I mean, bear in mind, all I've written about for 15 years is corporate crime. When you get into a crime, you go, well, what was their intent? What did they know? All of these issues come into play that come down to, you know, can you charge this person with having the knowledge and intent required to say that what they did was illegal at the time they did it? And it's sort of, to me, it's always been beside the point. It is much more, well, what did they do? Did they contribute to this collapse? And at the end of the day, when you stand back and you look at what happened, you know, again, I have never seen a company that was more thoroughly mismanaged than Enron. And, you know, and Ken Lay was the chairman and chief executive during most of that time.
Now, Kurt Eichenwald, tell us exactly what happened. There's a piece that I read your piece in the Times yesterday. Mm-hmm. And there was a point at which Enron went through a week when their cash flow literally vanished like water in the Gobi Desert. What happened and who was responsible for the fact that suddenly they had no cash flow?
Well, ultimately what happened was that the marketplace panicked. I mean, the way to think of it is Enron was a company that its executives had soaked the place in gasoline, and suddenly somebody lit a match.
But who were the executives that soaked it in gasoline?
Oh, well, there are so many. This would be, certainly you would want to start with Andy Fastow, who was the chief financial officer.
And who was forced out.
And when was forced out, he's the fellow who ultimately was found to have basically stolen $60 million.
Wow.
And, you know, this money went into his accounts, and he did it by these complex machinations that put Enron's own financial health at risk. But as you go through the list of people, I mean, you really got everybody who was involved in the $11 to $13 billion of investments in businesses that turned out to be complete disasters. I mean, the one thing that has been so misunderstood about Enron, they're celebrated as brilliant people who just happen to be criminals. And it's like, no, that's not quite true. In fact, they're very, very foolish people, very reckless people, who among them have a number of criminals.
Hmm. Now, Kurt, there was a point at which there was a question about some investments that Enron had made. And the issue of someone's gay lover came up. Explain to us exactly what happened there.
There was, I'm going to make this book sound like it's an unbelievably complex amount of accounting. In fact, it's really written to read like a thriller. So, but basically, the off-books partnerships are legal things. They're allowed to have them so long as they are independent. And independence has a lot of rules that you have to follow in order to understand, you know, this is an entity that is separate from the company. What they did is they set up an entity that was supposed to be separate from the company.
That would be Chuco?
That would be Chuco. And that entity was going to be a co-investor with Enron in a bunch of energy properties. Well, the outside investor in that instance was the gay lover of a finance executive at Enron. What you'll see in part two of the excerpt running next week, that they actually rested the logic of, well, this is independent, on the fact that Texas has anti-sodomy laws at the time, so therefore it's not a legal relationship. It was sort of, one of the accountants said, it's a pretty thin reed to hold things on, that you're basing a $7 billion accounting judgment on anti-sodomy laws.
So that's why they're against gay marriage, huh?
Well, it's sort of one of the funniest things in the world is that if gay marriage was legal in Texas, they wouldn't have been able to argue that Chuco was a valid entity.
So let me get back to how much now obviously, you know, Ken Lay had a relationship with George Sr. He had a relationship with Clinton. How much did the political world enable Enron by deregulating the energy industry?
The political world is, you know, to a degree is sort of like, you know, the dumb guy sitting down the block who waves at everybody as they pass.
Everyone's dumb in your world, Kurt. Are you the only smart guy on the planet, Kurt?
No. All right. There were smart people. There were a lot of people inside the company and outside the company who were blowing the whistle.
Yeah.
Got their legs cut out from under them whenever they tried.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really hard. You're sitting here, you're spelling off all the people who lost money and all the wreckage that took place. Pretty hard to say, wow, there's a lot of smart people out there.
Well, that's what's interesting. If we could play a little piece of sound with you on the phone here from last night about the hubris, you know, involved in personalities like Ken Lay. Let's play that, Chris.
The Department of Justice says you're a criminal. The title of the book suggests all of you were fools. Which is it?
I don't think I'm a criminal, number one. Am I a fool? I don't think I'm a fool, but I think I sure was fooled.
That was Ken Lay talking to Scott Pelley. Now, Kurt Eichenwald, I mean, this guy has got an out here. Why doesn't he just say, I'm a dummy, I mismanaged it? He's too proud to even do that.
I have marveled at Lay's inability to say, boy, did I mess up. And it's actually very interesting. There's an interview I did with him for The Times, and in which we talked about probably the single worst corporate decision ever made in the history of America, where they allowed their chief financial officer to be knowingly in a conflicted position with the company. And this results in everything terrible that happens. And I looked, you know, from the beginning, that is so clearly a bad idea. And his response is, oh, that's just 20/20 hindsight. As if you couldn't know going into it that having the guy who's in charge of the corporate finances in a conflicted position where his own personal financial interests run counter to that of the company is a bad idea. You know, it's like, of course it's a bad idea up front, but he can't get there. So I do find that kind of fascinating.
Well, you know, is he at least broke?
Not hardly.
The better question is, will he be broke?
And okay.
The answer to that is yes. Right now, you know, he did have almost all of his personal investments in Enron stock. He is down to what will sound like a lot of money. He is down to $20 million. Now, you've got to throw on the other side of that, he has several billion dollars in civil liability and absolutely no insurance.
So he's screwed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, somebody once said to me, well, I'd like to have $20 million. And I said, you know, I wouldn't trade that $20 million if it came with his liabilities for everything I have, for a buck in my pocket.
All right.
Ultimately, you know, he's walking into court, and whatever judgment he gets, and he's going to get judgments against him, he's going to have to pay for.
Good. I hope he'd be wearing a barrel when he walks into court. Hey, Kurt, it was great talking to you. Good luck with the book. Thank you for the information.
Thank you, guys.
I appreciate you, Kurt.
That was Kurt Eichenwald. The book is Conspiracy of Fools, a true story of, you know, the nuts and bolts of the Enron disaster. And it's a big book, folks. I would definitely recommend it. I'm going to try and read parts of it We'll be back with the job listing after that. This is 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition, the highest rated, most respected news show in America on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Good morning. It's Monday, folks. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yeah.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Good morning, Austin, Texas. It's our first day in Austin. Pleasure to be here. Love Austin, Texas. I was just, when was I there? It was a while back, but the last time I was there, I had some great barbecue. Is that, that's it? I'm weird. I'm really food-oriented. Yeah, and also, Austin, Texas, despite who occupied the Capitol, has a beautiful state capitol. We know, like, a lot of you people out there are out of work, and you spent your Sunday leafing through the want ads or monster.com, and we want to help be part of the solution, not the problem for you folks. So here's our Morning Sedition Monday job listing. Church Council President. Christ Lutheran Church in Park City, Kansas, had its council president placed on hiatus after he was arrested and charged with the BTK serial killings. So the church has sent out this notice. Christ Lutheran Church is looking for a temporary church council president. We need someone who can help out church staff and parishioners without binding, torturing, or killing them. This is an unpaid position, so what we are looking for the most is simply a person who is motivated, cheerful, and incapable of brutal torture slayings. Duties include preparing for church and Sunday school functions. Church buildings and grounds should be kept neat, orderly, and free of bodies, murder implements, and scattered semen evidence. Also, you will be asked to perform simple office duties on the church computer without using it to taunt law enforcement. Law enforcement. Wow. This is a temporary position while our current council president is indisposed. We expect the time frame to be at least 99 years to life. Please don't be another killer. There you go. That was one of the macabre ones that we do occasionally. Yes. Okay, so let's talk about this. Before we get into this, I just want to say that, you know, Bush is apparently, you know, in some ways politically distancing himself from his Social Security plans, but not the people that work for Bush, judging by this advertisement, which we were able to pull off a website recently.
The American Association of Retired Persons is opposing President Bush's plans for Social Security. Why would they do that? If you want to know the truth about old people, talk to the people who know them.
Old people are needy. I need a ride. I need a walker. I need something to eat. Could somebody please help me? I'm in the toilet. I can't get out. It's horrendous.
I had to spend 15 minutes helping my mother find her glasses because she forgot where she put them. Just forgot.
Dude, they crap in their pants.
Enough about World War II. I get it. You were there.
I'm sorry, but if you're going to dinner at 4 o'clock, you really don't need more money.
You liberated Auschwitz. You were there. I understand. Can we watch The Apprentice now?
And when they wear those diapers, they can pee right on themselves, too. Just pee.
Brian! My name is Brian! God!
I remember this one time, my uncle, he was on the floor. I thought he was having a heart attack or he was dead or something. Turns out he wasn't. Just on the floor.
Who the hell is Bobby? Nobody knows Bobby!
Dude, they crapped their pants.
Old people. They oppose President Bush's plans for Social Security. Isn't it time they died already?
Paid for by Swift Boat Veterans for whatever cause is being funded by the right-wing millionaires at the moment.
Man, Riley, they'll stop at nothing. They're shameless.
That's right.
So this is good news, though, in some respects that, you know, Bush is starting to hit a wall a little bit. I mean, you know, I don't think he cares. I think this guy sees the finish line. He knows that, you know, he's going to come out of this looking to the people that care about him and like him as some sort of great leader. But the truth of the matter is, there's some stuff going that's being sort of stifled. You know, first of all, you know, the Democrats are not going to budge on the Social Security thing. None of them are going to vote for whatever the hell he he's going to present if it has anything to do with private accounts or the Enronization of Social Security. His proposal to extend tax cuts for 5 years is running into opposition from Senate GOP leaders who are supporting a budget that holds tax cuts at $70 billion rather than the $100 billion that Bush wants to help his friends. Bush's efforts to allow religious groups receiving federal grants to consider a job applicant's religious beliefs has an uncertain future, thank God.
He's been working hard on that one, by the way.
Yeah, that's his...
behind the scenes.
He likes those. And his initiative to control power plant emissions was rejected last week by a Republican-controlled Senate committee. His energy plan remains stalled after two unsuccessful attempts to get it through Congress in the first term. So there are definitely some obstacles, and the Social Security thing, I think people are getting hip to the fact that it doesn't make sense for America.
Well, what he's doing, Mark, is what he normally does here. He pushes the envelope out a certain distance, and then as he sees the level of opposition to his initiative, he pulls back little by little by little. He's still talking about, well, we want to be flexible. We still are open to all kinds of ideas. We heard last week his people, specifically Treasury Secretary Snow, hint at the possibility that the accounts will be supplemental rather than accompanied by a reduction in benefits. We haven't heard much of that part lately, but the idea of dealing with life expectancy and cutting benefits with regard to people's life expectancy, which is something that at least one senator, Chuck Hagel, has proposed, is something that he's listening to. He's not saying he's embracing it, but he is listening to it. And, of course, Charles Grassley has undercut him by saying that Congress ought to focus on the solvency of Social Security rather than on the private accounts.
There you go. And this guy, this fellow here, the Norman Ornstein, a political analyst with the American Enterprise Institute, agreed with what you said last week, Riley. The whole approach that Bush normally works is to push the envelope, as you just said, and I'm quoting here, then embrace the opposition and claim victory.
Yep.
That's exactly how you put it last week.
Yeah, and that's exactly what he's going to continue to do as long as that formula works, and he will take credit for Social Security no matter what happens. And I think private accounts are off the table as we speak.
Okay, can we bet on that?
Sure.
$15.
$15, you got it, man.
Okay, now we're going to talk about
gambling.
You're
paying me from the money you made from Caleb.
Oh, all right, we're going to talk about Tom Delay. Talking about gambling.
Yeah.
He used some money that somebody won in the wrong way.
Sick puppy.
Yeah.
We come to him next on Air America Radio.
Do you know where...
Six past the hour. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor but are tolerant. Good for you. Mark Riley, how you doing?
I'm doing okay.
I'm doing the top of the hour things again because we got new people listening. Good morning, Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
We're on 1600 AM KOKE live every morning from 5 to 8 Central Time there in Austin, Texas. Love Austin, Texas. Wish I could remember the name of that place where I had that barbecue that time. It was one of these places my buddy Hunt takes me over there. You know, he drives me to, it looks like someone's house, Riley. Someone's house. We park next to this house. We go in. You buy it by the pound. There's pictures of everybody all over the place. I wish I knew what street it was on. I think it was like 19th Street. I can't remember. I can't remember. It's killing me. If you're listening in Austin, what's the name of that barbecue place I ate at? Call me up. 866-303-2270. Call me if you ate... if you know the name of the barbecue place I ate at in Austin, it's like some guy's house almost, and you buy it, they weigh it on a scale, and there's pictures of popular entertainers all over the place, and that's all I know. It was very good. They have links and, you know, the whole business. So what else? Okay, here we go. I'm going to be performing in San Francisco at Cobb's Comedy Club. That's April 1st and 2nd. So you people listening to 960 AM, The Quake in San Francisco, come on down or come further away. Come down from wherever you are. Here we go. What else? Watton Smalls is on vacation this week, so we're letting you vote for your favorite Planet Bush reports at MorningSedition.com, and we're playing the winners. Go to MorningSedition.com right now to vote, and tune in tomorrow to hear the first winner. I will be on Randy Rhodes tomorrow night with Lewis Black. Lewis is the host of the show. I will be supporting Lewis. Who knows?
That doesn't mean you'll be a guest on the show.
No, I'm going to be hanging out with him for a few hours. Okay. And Janine's going to come in and hang with him a few hours. I've known Lewis Black for a million years. I knew him way back when. He's been at it a long time. Very funny guy. What else is going on? Oh, okay. I went to see the Mammoth play.
Saturday romance. Night.
Yeah, Bob Balaban came in Friday, said go see it. I went to see it. He was great. But I'll tell you one thing, Riley. If I can just reach over here and get this, I'll tell you one thing. The guy who played the judge, Larry Brigman, Okay. All right, now, I didn't realize he'd been on a soap opera, As the World Turned, forever. All right, but the last time, he's one of these guys where I see him, and I'm like, I know that guy. He's some character actor. He was in Injustice for All. Did you see Injustice for All?
No.
With Al Pacino? Sure you did. No, what was it?
I
went to a movie, Riley. Injustice for All.
80-something.
I'm out of order. You're out of order. This whole court is out of order. All right, well, the guy who played the attorney that he asked to help him out and represent that transvestite that, you know, was supposed to just get arranged or something, and the guy, you know, didn't show up with the right information, and the guy ended up hanging himself in his cell. That guy who played that lawyer was the guy who played the judge in this. He's obviously 30 years later, but I'll tell you, the play, it's a farce, as Balaban said. And it's just frenetic. I mean, it's just like, you know, there's just these characters who are pretty grounded characters, but they're blasting through stuff. You know, there's also this stuff about the Middle East crisis. There's stuff about political correctness. There's stuff about racism. There's stuff about gay marriage, about, you know, homosexual issues in the court. There's stuff about the nature of justice. And it's like it doesn't adhere to any, you know, real narrative except this loose narrative about a chiropractor who thinks he can save the world or create peace in the Middle East. That's all I'm going to give you.
It's funny. Tall order.
It's playing at the Atlantic Theater, and I'll tell you, when the second act hits, you know, hang on to your seat, because Brigman, as the judge, does some real comic mastery. It's a very sort of, it's intentionally confusing, bordering on the absurd, but the rapid-fire nature of it and the form that he's trying to get at, this farce, it's almost like a Kaufman and Hart style thing, it almost works throughout the whole play, but the second act is great. The first act, it gets a little slow, and it's not that long of a play, so it can't really afford that. The language is quick, but for some reason the characters really kick in, and you get that sort of mammoth lyricism, that mammoth alliterative quality, the back and forth.
That sense of inertia.
Oh, definitely.
In conversation. Yeah, I know exactly what
you're... But he's really pushing buttons, you know, with language and with the nature of justice. And then there's this whole sort of gay relationship under theme that's very interesting. It's crazy because it doesn't adhere to a strict narrative, really.
Mm. Now, a couple of people called with answers to your question. Was it a place called Sam's?
It might have been Sam's.
Or was it a place called Christ?
No, it wasn't Christ. That guy said it's like 20 miles out. No, this was definitely right. It was right in Austin, and it was, it was right in just, I think it was in the black neighborhood.
Mueller's?
In Austin.
No, that wouldn't have been the black.
I think it was Sam's.
Okay, because there's no black people named Mueller anywhere in America.
No, it wasn't Mueller's.
It
was definitely like, it was a white, sort of like, it looked like it was once a house, and I believe it was on 19th Street and had a great meal. I like barbecue. I used to.
Not Tom DeLay's Chop House.
Tom DeLay's Chop House. No, he's going to go to the Chop House. They're going to take him apart, man. I'm not, you know, back when I ate the meat, Chris, Kalo, the Costco.
Yeah, you know, he came here with the bacon. Bacon again, twice now.
Taunting my borderline vegetarian arse. Boy, I'm telling you, it got hard. It's getting harder, man. The meat is looking... I'm starting to really jones for meat, bro.
Uh-oh.
It's gorgeous. That is some nice-looking bacon. That is some nice-looking
bacon. Apple bacon.
All right, hey, bacon, okay. That's not that stuff that you get. That's not the house brand at A&B.
Oh, no.
This is real deal.
Yeah. Apple-cured. Listen to him buying the bit.
Apple-cured,
you know,
bacon.
This is cured for a few days underneath an old oak tree made from, you know... All right, look. Here we go. Let's talk about Tom DeLay, because right here, this is no longer some sort of isolated issue that the... Republicans can hide anymore, my friends. I mean, this is page one of the Washington Post today. Quote, if death comes from 1,000 cuts, Tom DeLay is into a couple hundred and it's getting up there. End quote. This is said by a Republican political consultant close to key lawmakers. I quote again, the situation is negatively fluid right now for the guy.
I love that. The
negatively
situation
fluid.
Is negatively fluid.
Love it. Love it. You start hitting
He's
arteries.
He's going down. That's what they're trying to say.
You start hitting arteries, it only takes a couple. End quote. The bug-killing dwarf king of the neocon death cult's legislative pig pack is starting to take the heat. Apparently, he was hospitalized last week for irregular heartbeat and fatigue. It's starting to crumble. Pride hurts, doesn't it, Tom? I guess you can't be as dirty as you are and do the back room dealing as much as you did with such arrogance and hubris and expect to get off scot-free. This is a guy that tries to change the rules of the legislature so he doesn't have to take a hit. What? How did he do that?
Well, they had a House, the House committee that deals with ethics, actually was, they had changed a couple of procedures that would have dismissed the allegations unless they had an actual majority of the committee. And the committee, of course, is split down the middle. So in this case, tie would have gone to the runner being Tom DeLay.
But they didn't agree to that part.
No,
they
didn't agree to that part. But what's happening is DeLay seems to be getting ensnared in several situations all at the same time. He made two trips, one to Britain, one to Korea, and they're starting to ask now exactly who it was that bankrolled this. Plus, people are looking now at the fact that several of his colleagues have kicked in a monstrous amount of money to his legal defense fund, which is now holding $250,000.
I feel liberals and progressives and Democrats salivating out there as we set this story up. So when we come back, we're going to tell you the details of how he's getting it from all sides, and I'm excited about it, Mark Ryan.
Me too.
Is it wrong? Is it evil of me to be excited about the downfall of this particular guy?
Why?
I don't think exactly. It's politics.
That's
and
right.
It's about time. It's 14 past the hour. Air America Radio. Patty, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
Monday morning, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. We're talking about the potential and hopeful demise of the bug-killing dwarf king of the neocon death cult legislating pig pack, Tom DeLay, possibly going down. Would like to read from Lawrence W. Britt from the 14 Characteristics of Fascism, which I've been hitting. And don't think Nazi, think fascism. Number 13, rampant cronyism and corruption. Those in business circles and close to the power elite often use their position to enrich themselves. This corruption worked both ways. The power elite would receive financial gifts and property from the economic elite, who in turn would gain the benefit of government favoritism. Members of the power elite were in a position to obtain vast wealth from other sources as well, for example, by stealing national resources or maybe, recutting the districts in their state. With the national security apparatus under control and the media muzzled, this corruption was largely unconstrained and not well understood by the general population. Well, not anymore. We're giving you some understanding. Riley, let's do the Mark Riley hyperparse. Now, this isn't nobody either. This is Time Magazine. This is page one of the Washington Post. This is Newsweek. I mean, they're coming down on DeLay. The hammer's getting hammered.
Well, he's got several fronts on which he now has to fight. And that's why his defense fund apparently has gotten so balkanized. There is the issue of TRIPAC, which is his political action committee in Texas, and whether or not, because two of the people that work with them are already indicted. Mm-hmm. And there have been some questions as to whether or not DeLay would be indicted in connection with those same charges, and that is that TRIPAC accepted and doled out illegal campaign contributions.
We're closing in on you, Tom.
Okay, now, there are two other problems he's got. Well, actually, one other problem involving two different trips. One of which was a trip to South Korea, which, if it was paid for by the people that they say it was paid for, it would constitute a violation of House rules.
Right.
So that would be, he would get at the very least a slap on the wrist for that. There's also the question of the trip that he took to Great Britain, which he said was to confer with other concerns. It was kind of sounded like the Wizard of Oz. Remember when the wizard was getting ready to leave, he said he was going to confer with other wizards in other places?
Yes.
Well, in this instance, DeLay said he was going to commiserate with conservatives like Margaret Thatcher in England and conservatives in Scotland and find out how they can help each other. And lo and behold, DeLay, an avid golfer, ends up going to Scotland to St. Andrews. St. Andrews, for those of you who don't play golf, is the birthplace of golf. So DeLay somehow managed during the $70,000 trip to manage to commiserate with conservatives on a golf course. But the real question here is precisely who paid for that trip.
Okay.
And again, this was $70,000 involved his chief of staff, another assistant, their spouses, and their records of what was spent on this trip. Doesn't exactly jive with it.
Yeah, it doesn't jive with this National Center for Public Policy Research, which is used to be Jack Abramoff, who was a lobbyist who was in charge of some Indian casinos in Mississippi, who bought delay to push through legislation that would enable them to operate more freely.
Yeah, to continue to operate. There was also a company called eLottery based in Connecticut who, if this particular piece of legislation had passed, would have been put out of business. So they wanted to continue operating. So they, too, supposedly paid the center, and that money somehow wound up with DeLay going on this trip to Britain. Now, DeLay says he didn't know that the money was from the Choctaw Indians or from this eLottery.
So see how they do it? See how they do it? See, this money comes into this center, this what, I don't even know what you would call it. It's a mediating group set up by this lobbyist.
Dispersal unit.
Dispersal unit. That's fine. You know, but it enables Tom DeLay to do what you called, to do what you said earlier, plausible deniability. These guys are all about protecting themselves by blaming whoever the hell they can.
Yeah.
And the more things that are in between them and the action, it gives them more leeway to blame. But this guy's so dirty that, you know, he's running out of places to turn, and his heart's beating irregularly, and he's fatigued because, you know, he's screwed. His hubris is going to take him down. But this guy, Jack Abramoff, is also going down, and they're detaching from each other.
Yes, they are.
And the thing about, you know, these things about, you know, what do your books say versus my books is, like, you know what these guys did. They took the trip. They had a great time. They get home. They're like, well, let's look at our receipts. Screw the receipts. Let's just, you know, let's just wing it. Let's just estimate how much we spent on this trip. We can write it all off. Who the hell doesn't do that in business? Well, now they're getting called on it because they're not just in business. They're politicians who are supposed to be operating at the behest of the people of this country, not at the behest of major interests in corporate interests, business interests, anybody but the people. These guys have been screwing the system long enough, hooking people out of their money. I hope the hell he goes down.
You know, when you start putting all of these people together, the schemers at Enron, the schemers in DeLay's office, the schemers with these public relations firms, it is extraordinary to see the extent people are willing to game the American public. Like, all of these decisions that are made are based solely on the merits, based solely on ethics, based solely on concerns that Americans are supposed to have. And the fact of the matter is that these folks are lining their stinking pockets every opportunity they get.
How long has it been like that? Like, you know, the more I do this job and the more that, you know, you and I sit and talk about stuff and the more informed I get, the more educated I get, I start to realize that American politics has never been that much different than it is now. It's just really bad right now.
Yeah.
And the weird thing about most Americans that really, you know, eats me, and I used to be one of them to a certain degree, I knew who I hated. I knew who my gut feelings determined for me to say, like, I'm uncomfortable with that guy because he's evil. I mean, I used to trust my gut instincts on that. But I know that most people, you know, they're like, you know, hey, dude, the election's over. Take it easy.
Yeah.
It's like, no, if we're not vigilant, if we don't somehow put this information together in a challenging and entertaining way for people to listen to out there, I mean, don't turn the dial. I mean, this stuff is important. We're supposed to have a say in this. We're supposed to be mildly informed enough to make decisions that are better than the one that, you know, 59 million people just made.
Let's share a little mild information with our audience, okay? Put aside all of the tricks. Put aside all of this foolishness with the Choctaws and eLottery, all the rest of these people. Ask yourself, Americans, this simple question. Does it make sense to have on an ethics committee that is supposed to be investigating Tom DeLay, two individuals, one from Texas, one from Oklahoma, who contributed to his defense fund? Does that make sense to anybody? Again, two people that are going to sit in judgment of Tom DeLay also gave money to Tom DeLay's legal defense fund.
Unbelievable.
All right, you know, I'm not making this up. It's in the papers, folks.
Well, it's kind of rigged right now. But you know what? The cracks are starting to show, you know, in this House and in this Senate, and it's all good. But let me just tell you, you know, how, you know, this is another reason why, you know, people should stay informed. I'm also going to tell you when we come back what Tom DeLay, he's got a little sign in his office that has implications that I think are happening quicker for him than they thought it would for the entire planet. But I'll tell you what that sign says when we come back. Also, we'll talk about how the Congress is about thinking about, hey, you know what? You know, there's a way that we can balance the budget a little more. Starve the poor people.
Oh, yeah.
That's terrific. You know, and I don't want to sound like I'm on a soapbox or anything, but I am kind of.
Yeah, why not?
All right.
We need to be on it.
All right. Well, all right.
All right.
So you'll stand up here with me?
Yeah, I'll stand up there with you until the first rock home.
Oh, then I'm on my own.
Only kidding.
Get a catcher's mitt.
We'll be back with more here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
34 past the hour, folks. Morning's edition here on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley sitting over there.
Yes, it is.
And right now, you know, sometimes it's hard to read the headlines. So it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So I just bought a brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator that we have right here in the studio. And let's crank this baby up and feed some headlines. From the New York Times, government report on U.S. aviation warns of security holes. Put that in the machine. Government report on U.S. aviation warns of security holes. Translation, government dares terrorists to take another shot. From Fox News. From Fox News, courtroom massacre hostage kept cool. Throw that into the machine there. Courtroom massacre hostage kept cool. Translation, hostage pees on self. Oh. Hey, from the Associated Press, Iger succeeding, is that his name? Iger, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Iger succeeding Eisner as Disney CEO. Put that in the machine. Iger succeeding Eisner as Disney CEO. Translation, movies still suck, different guy making them. There you go.
Where's my ringtone, Brendan?
That's so funny. So let's talk to a guy that knows what he's talking about. What do you say, Riley? I just made a
you
hook
just
shot.
Made a hook shot,
man. Into a garbage can, barely looking.
Casual as can be.
Like Sam Karras. You know, he's sitting on the phone going, oh, I'm up. I got to talk to these guys. Right now, from the American Prospect, joining us from Washington, D.C., he's the congressional guy for the American Prospect. Good morning, Sam Roosevelt. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Hey, Sam.
We're pretty good. So what's going on down there? We're talking about Tom DeLay here. Are you guys pretty excited that he's going?
Did he look like he's going down, Sam?
It's amazing stuff. He looks like he's gone down in the past. So,
but come on, there's more of a momentum, Sam, isn't there?
There is. There was this kind of a momentum when he got the admonishments.
Can you just explain to me one thing, though, before we get into the bulk of the other things we need to talk about? Because I'm curious about this. Can you tell me about the two things he tried, the two rules that he tried to change in order to protect himself within the Congress?
You mean in the ethics rule?
Yeah.
Well, let me remember. I mean, you know, first they had, it was just the inter-party rule.
Right.
Saying that any leader who got indicted would have to step down from his leadership, and so his party rallied around there. What they actually did with the Ethics Committee, they wanted to do a few things, and what got through and what has caused this impasse now in the Ethics Committee is it used to be that as long as half of the committee voted for something, the investigation could go through. Now you need a majority, meaning you need a Republican to vote for investigating somebody.
Because it's a ten-person committee and it's split 5-5, right?
Exactly.
Democrat, Republican.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's the one that went through, and it got kind of obscured because they had sort of made a big deal out of stepping back from some of the other things they were pushing.
Does that mean that nobody will ever get investigated now? Especially Republicans, obviously.
Oh, sure. At the moment, the Ethics Committee is completely shut down. Democrats have said they're not going to Democrats within the committee said they're not going to proceed until they reinstate that rule. So at the moment, effectively, the Ethics Committee is completely shut down.
But what does that mean ultimately, Sam? Does that mean that this standoff could go on for the rest of Bush's administration, right? For the whole term, right?
Well, that's the thing. So this is sort of it's a total PR political fight at this point, because Republicans would love to just have the Ethics Committee shut down and stand up for the next 4 years. The Democrats' thinking is over the next few weeks, as you said, all this momentum's going on, all this news coverage of delay stuff of all sorts of dimensions. They're going to try and drum up enough momentum to actually get some changes into the Ethics Committee.
Now, Sam, I mean, at a point, you have to wonder, you have two members of the Ethics Committee who have contributed to Tom DeLay's defense committee. Is there no uproar about that?
No, well, I mean, not only that, Lamar Smith, one of those two, it's now been reported in 2002, led a fundraiser,
yeah.
Yeah, in Texas for TRIMPAC, the exact political action committee that's the focus of this investigation by Ronnie Earle. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's the way they did it. They were very systematic in trying to essentially shut down the Ethics Committee, and now the Democrats have balked and called them out on it.
Oh, well, that's good. So let's shift focus to the budget. The resolution goes up for debate in the House and the Senate. How come Congress is proposing like a bigger diversionary spending cuts than was originally proposed by the president, discretionary?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, Bush had like two different numbers. He had we actually called for in the budget over the next 5 years is, as you said, for Medicaid, especially about half of what the Senate and the House is calling for. But he had another number of $60 billion that could be cut from waste, fraud, and abuse that was always sort of it was never pegged anything. It was kind of imaginary. So they kind of met him halfway and are calling for $15 billion in Medicaid cuts in the next 5 years. It's happening because Jim Nussel in the House and especially Judd Gregg in the Senate, those are the two budget committee chairmen, are very, very big on cutting entitlement spending. They've been wanting to do this for a while now.
So this is going along with their policy of adapt or die.
Sure, sure.
I get it.
Mm-hmm. Sam,
I don't think that's their slogan.
No, not exactly.
Not yet.
Right.
Well, Sam, what about the whole issue of cutting, rather than cutting farm subsidies, as Bush had proposed, they would rather, some people in Congress apparently, would rather cut into nutritional programs, like food stamps, for example.
Yeah.
Is there really any waste to be found? I thought they trimmed most of that.
There's no waste. There's just the food stamp program that they're going to cut. I mean, this was most people who saw Bush talking about cutting farm subsidies in the first place immediately thought that this was just an end run to kind of, indirectly just squeeze food stamps. Because it's very hard to cut farm subsidies. They have a powerful constituency, and happens to be in the same committee as food stamps. So, yeah.
And the Department of Agriculture, right?
Right, right. And the House chair of the Agriculture, I think, has been reported as all but saying that, look, we're going to cut this out of food stamps.
So, well, you can understand that, though. You know, their logic is that, you know, what it's just food for poor people.
Right. I mean, you know.
What do they need food for?
And, you know, where's the campaign scratch? Where's the donation?
Exactly. Yeah, where do we benefit from this? There's plenty of garbage cans around.
Right. And that same logic's going on elsewhere in Ways and Means. It looks like they're going to squeeze money out of EITC. That is indirect. I mean,
the Earned Income Tax Credit.
Yeah, which is, you know, which was a Republican program in the first place, an incredibly successful anti-poverty program. But they want to look like they're, you know, cutting the deficit. So they got these instructions. The thing about the budget is they don't come with specific programs they want cut. They're just instructions to each committee, and so they send a set amount of money. They say cut out of mandatory programs you have under your jurisdiction, and they know that what's going to happen is that these, weaker clients, the EIC, food stamps, that's what's going to get cut.
Now, would you include Amtrak among those weaker clients? I mean, are we seeing the end of Amtrak as we now know it with this budget?
No, I doubt it. Rick Santorum, I don't know if you've noticed, he's trying to kind of rebrand himself in the last couple of weeks as a moderate, because he's, you know, he has a tough re-election fight ahead of him. So he's already championing Amtrak. He's a powerful guy. Usually Amtrak ends up, there's enough. The day Amtrak dies is the day there's finally no more Republicans in the Northeast.
Interesting. Sam, let me shift gears real quick. We had the head of the House Government Reform Committee and the ranking Democrat both on Meet the Press yesterday talking steroids. Tom Davis and Henry Waxman say that they are going to force players to comply with subpoenas. Curt Schilling, the eighth pitcher for the Boston Red Sox, has already said he will go testify. Who's going to win this spitting match between Congress and Major League Baseball, and how serious is this House committee in bringing these folks before them?
I think Congress and very serious. It was a weird thing. I mean, I don't know if they expected such blanket refusal at first on the part of the players, but a lot of people think of this as kind of a weird, overreaching, finger-wagging exercise on the part of both Waxman and Davis. This isn't a particularly partisan thing. Waxman had wanted to do this in the first place, but at the same time, it's hard if the United States Congress subpoenas you. It's hard. You're not really supposed to just not show up. So,
well, Major League Baseball is saying that Congress doesn't have jurisdiction. Do they have a point?
Oh, I think they kind of do have a point. My guess is if a few of these guys show up, they're not going to push for the other, you know, they're not going to push for Mark McGwire to show up if, Giambi and Schilling show up or something.
Well, if they really want to fill the house, they should.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And where's Barry Bonds?
Yeah.
But, you know, the interesting thing is Jose Canseco apparently is going to be testifying, and he's the one that laid the steroid thing at the feet of the president, saying Bush must have known when he was owner of the Texas Rangers.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole, it all made sense why he started talking about steroids when no one else was.
Wasn't he selling a book, too?
Yeah, he was.
Canseco? Yeah. Well, yeah, he'll be. He's definitely showing up to this.
Will he be signing books in Congress?
Right, exactly. I don't think there's a law.
Okay, Sam. Great talking to you. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, that was Sam Rosenfeld, web writer for the American Prospect. He covers the Congress. I left you hanging on this. The plaque behind Tom DeLay's desk says, "This could be the day," and it's in reference to the rapture. And I think his day, his personal rapture, is upon him.
Would his indictment be his rapture?
Wow. And talking about his hubris, Tom DeLay to a D.C. restaurant manager after the manager asked him to extinguish his cigar because he was violating the law. The federal government said, quote, "I am federal government." Mm. That is the bug-killing dwarf king of the neocon death cult legislative pig pack, hopefully going down soon. We're going to do more about him later. Coming up after the break, we have morning remembrance, so you want to hang on for the inappropriateness of that. 4-5 past the hour, Aaron McCready.
I'm Reverend Al Sharpton, and you're listening to Morning's Edition. Talk about the issues we're fighting for our lives here on Air America Radio.
This is... Hey, we're back. It's 49 past the hour. We're going to land this thing if we can. Look, folks, I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley's Morning's Edition.
Yep.
All right? Welcome aboard Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
Nice to have you.
Yeah.
Look, I unfortunately, it's that time of week again when we hear Morning's Edition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Jeff Raskin, computer pioneer. Jeff Raskin, the software developer behind Apple Computer's pioneering Macintosh personal computer, died this month when he inexplicably froze up after making a series of cute electronic frog noises. A coroner's examination later revealed the system to be full of viruses and bugs. Speaking of bugs, I think I got one.
You all right?
Yeah, I guess. My eyes are tearing up.
You want some Kleenex or something?
Yeah, that's bugs.
Okay.
Legend has it that Raskin named the Macintosh computer after his favorite kind of apple. After failing miserably with the Bramley Pippins, Luxton's Cornish Tart, and the poorly received Tiderman's Mealy Yellow Varietal. You got some apples in here, Mark?
You allergic to them?
Yeah, the blooming. When did they bloom?
I had a pear.
Yeah, Braeburns.
Oh, Braeburns, yeah.
You got a Braeburn here, I know you. Anyway, let me get on with this, will you?
All right, will you?
You're always delaying me.
You want a Kleenex or something?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, why don't you just have this Kleenex here? Oh. Okay, that's not bad.
There you go.
Okay, good.
Raskin's latest project featured a computer interface designed to operate with ease on any operating system, including Windows and Apple. And for that reason alone, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs had to have him killed.
You need another tissue?
Yeah, thanks.
Oh, that's okay.
Either. Turn up. Raskin, who helped Macintosh design the first successful graphical user interface featuring icons in Windows, requested his body be dragged and dropped into a trash can, and then deleted. I wish I could delete these allergies, huh? Oh. George Wackenhut, security expert. George R. Wackenhut was a former FBI agent who built his Wackenhut Corporation into an international security firm that promoted the use of private guards at prisons. The 85-year-old disciplinarian recently died of a heart attack after mumbling something about, quote, spending a night in the box just to see what it was really like.
What? All right.
Onions in here. You chopping onions?
Maybe I do have an apple or something.
To impress potential clients, Mr. Wackenhut liked to dress his guards up in helmets and paratrooper boots. Wasn't until years later that he decided to add pants. Hope they were cotton. Better for allergies, right?
Yeah, I guess. You want another Kleenex?
Let me get on with it.
All right.
Still a growing concern, the Whack and Hut Corporation has been accused of abusing inmates in Florida, Texas, and Louisiana. Soon hopes to expand to beating and starving prisoners in the Midwest and northern states as well. Midwest.
Yeah.
A lot of alfalfa fields.
Oh, yeah, you got allergies to that, too?
Very bad for the eyes. Alfalfa, you know, alfalfa grades.
Sure,
sure. Achoo! You hear that?
You sneezed a little.
Yeah.
It's weird. It sounded like one of those fake sneezes.
Oh, I'm not crying.
Not me.
At the time of his death, Akinhut controlled more than 40,000 prison beds around the world, making his company the largest sponsor of sodomy outside Neverland Ranch.
Oh, man.
Speaking of Michael Jackson, you got a llama in here, right?
Yeah.
Man, those things are shedding.
Yeah, you saw the llama when you walked in, didn't you?
Was that a llama?
Yeah.
Oh.
That must be why your eyes are running like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Thanks for tripping me up again.
Sure.
Anyway. This has been this week's Morning Remembrance. Until next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying, who's chopping on you?
Oh, man. Mort, it concerns me about, do you think these are the right tone? You know what I mean? The remembrance?
I'm doing my best here with the material I'm giving. You know, people die every week, and I can't help it.
No, I know. You think I tripped yet?
I think you had to lay me all these questions.
Yeah,
questions. You drag things on.
I get concerned. I get concerned. You come in here, you're all broken up. You're trying to honor the dead, and you can't, you know, I don't care about you.
You're a very caring man.
Yeah. Okay. All right, buddy.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, you take care. You know, and try and take care of that cold or allergies or whatever the hell it is.
Thanks for calling me on my vacation, by the way.
You're on vacation?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Oh, we had you on tape here. I thought you were just here. All right. All right, well, you know, I'm glad you're back. Does that mean anything to you?
No.
How did I know that was coming?
All right, well, I love you, Mort. How's that? Better?
Nope.
All right.
That was Mort Mortensen in the Morning Remembrance. Now it's time for the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here we go. This is your marching orders for today. One, start feeling conflicted about Ken Lay. Hate him for his corporate corruption, but offer to publish his sensitive prison poetry. Two, protest idea of Condoleezza Rice becoming commander-in-chief. When you hear she won't run, complain that no black women are running for president. That gets to it right there. Three, applaud American Idol finalists for dropping out. Why do we have to have winners and losers? Can't we all win? That's a good question. Four, applaud Michael Jackson's accused for having the guts to buck national opinion and point out that Jackson is kind of a wing nut. Yeah. Five, today's phrase is dropping into conversation. The glaciers are shrinking in the Himalayas, man. Am I the only one who read about this? Get your head out of the ice, sheeple. You think you can live without Himalayan glaciers? Think again. Wake up.
Uh-oh.
Oh, what a Monday, Riley.
It's been a heck of a Monday. Now, tomorrow, listeners will get a double dose of Mark Maron.
And also, Tom DeLay. We're going to talk more about this.
We're going to talk more about him. But you're going to be on tomorrow morning with us and tomorrow afternoon with Lewis Slack. And we're also going to talk about that little gnome columnist, Robert Novak.
Oh.
Have a good one, man.
You too, Riley.
It's Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition. Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Dave.